Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. I'm Nate Kazmarek, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of FedSoc Forum programs, become a Federal Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this Federal Society virtual event. My name is Marco J. Lloyd, and I'm Assistant Director of Networks with the Federal Society. Today, I'm excited to host a Courthouse Steps oral argument webinar on First Choice Women's Resource Center v. Plotkin, featuring Christopher Mills. Our moderator for today's discussion is Chris Bates. Chris is a shareholder at Kern McConkey, where he is co-chair of the firm's appellate section and a member of the litigation, First Amendment, and religious organization sections. His practice focuses on appeals and critical motions in complex cases, and he's argued dozens of cases in courts across the country, including the Utah Supreme Court, Utah Court of Appeals, and 11 of the 13 federal circuits. Chris has significant experience in senior positions in both state and federal government, previously serving as Deputy Solicitor General for Utah, Senior Counsel to the Assistant Attorney General for the Civil Division at the Department of Justice, and Chief Counsel to Senator Hatch on the Senate Judiciary Committee. If you'd like to learn more about today's speakers, their full bios can be viewed on our website, fedsoc.org. If you have a question at any point in today's program, please enter it into the Q&A function at the bottom of your Zoom window, and we will do our best to answer as many as we can. Finally, I'll note that, as always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues, and all expressions of opinion are those of the speakers. With that, thank you both for joining us today, and the floor is yours.
Well, thanks very much for that introduction, Marco. I'm very glad to be here today. Very glad to be here today with Christopher. We got two Chris's or two Christophers on today's webinar, so hopefully this will be interesting for folks. I'll do a brief introduction of Christopher. He's the founder of Spiro Law LLC in South Carolina. Before that, he was a partner at a national law firm and was a constitutional law fellow at the Beckett Fund. Christopher clerked for Justice Thomas on the Supreme Court and Judge Santel on the D.C. Circuit. He has authored briefs and motions, and I think pretty much every circuit court across the country. I think Christopher probably files as many amicus briefs from the Supreme Court as pretty much any other practitioner practicing today. So he's an expert on all things Supreme Court. He's arguing the Supreme Court as well as a number of federal circuits as well. He graduated from Harvard Law School, where he was an editor of Harvard Law Review, earned his undergrad from Furman University. He lives in Charleston with his wife, children, and golden retriever. So grateful to have Christopher here today. Looking forward to a great discussion. This is an interesting case, which I think has potential to actually be a pretty important case as well. You know, sometimes some of the issues in this case, you might think of somewhat dry jurisdictional issues, but given the context and some of the developments that have been happening in these issues in recent years and the way that these subpoenas have been used, this actually, I think, could be a case that ends up having some pretty significant consequences. So with that, I think let's go ahead and start with the background on the case. This procedural history here, this being a jurisdictional question, is both extremely important and a bit complicated. Christopher, can you walk us through what this case is about and how it made its way to the Supreme Court?
Sure. Thanks, Chris. So this case involves the First Choice Women's Resource Centers, a faith-based pregnancy center nonprofit organization in New Jersey. It received a subpoena from the New Jersey Attorney General's office asking for a lot of information, including some donor information. So the basic dispute is whether First Choice's constitutional challenge, which it brought in federal court, to this subpoena is ripe for adjudication in federal court. So that's the basic issue. Kind of the background, what was going on is the state seemed to have some hostility toward pregnancy centers. It was purportedly investigating whether donors might have been misled because supposedly one donation page sort of stated a pro-life mission, while a client-facing website didn't emphasize the pro-life angle as much as just helping women. Of course, this is not unusual at all for nonprofit organizations to have different sort of public facing and donor facing issues. And a big issue in the argument yesterday, which got a lot of attention, Justice Thomas asked the New Jersey lawyer, you know, were any actual complaints ever filed about this against this pregnancy center? And the answer after some hedging was no. So there was no complaint. What seemed to be going on was New Jersey doesn't like pregnancy centers and therefore is harassing them with a subpoena. As I said, the subpoena demanded the full names, phone numbers, addresses, and employment information of donors who gave to the pregnancy centers. The subpoena said that, quote, failure to comply may render you liable for contempt of court and other penalties as provided by law. So First Choice went to federal court, filed a claim under 1983, saying that the subpoena violated its First and 14th Amendment rights. It argued that the subpoena was out of retaliation or viewpoint discrimination due to the Attorney General's hostility toward pro-life pregnancy centers. The core constitutional challenge is whether the demand for donor identities objectively chills its associational and speech rights. First Choice alleged that compelled disclosure chills donors, particularly due to the pattern of violence and intimidation at pregnancy centers nationwide. They provided declarations from donors anonymously confirming that the possibility of their identities being disclosed made them less likely to donate. The district court here dismissed the lawsuit as unripe. The court held that the lawsuit would become ripe only once a state court required compliance with the subpoena under threat of contempt. The state indeed sought to enforce the subpoena in New Jersey Superior Court and state court. The state court denied First Choice's motion to quash, but didn't resolve First Choice's First Amendment arguments. It said those arguments were premature. It told the parties to continue negotiating. The Third Circuit, meanwhile, affirmed the district court's dismissal from federal court, holding that the First Choice's claims were not ripe. The court said that First Choice could continue asserting its constitutional claim back in state court. Judge Bevis dissented. He would have said that the constitutional challenge was ripe. And the Supreme Court granted review. The question presented was where the subject of a state investigatory demand has established a reasonably objective chill of its First Amendment rights. Is a federal court in a first filed action deprived of jurisdiction because those rights must be adjudicated in state court? So that's basically the background and setup here.
Yeah. I thought it was interesting in First Choice's opening brief, they let out by analogizing this case to the NAACP v. Alabama case from way back in the 50s or 60s, harking back to efforts, obviously during context, but when state officials use these requests for donor information as a way to really suppress the activities of nonprofit organizations. And so, sometimes things come back around, I guess. So we talked about the background, and Crispy, you talked about some of the constitutional questions at issue in the case, but how would you characterize what are really the important constitutional issues at stake here, and why do they matter? You know, yes, this case is about ripeness. It's a jurisdictional question, which sometimes can feel a bit dry to us, but what are the important questions really that are issued here, and why do they matter beyond just sort of, you know, what some might view as a somewhat dry technical jurisdictional question?
Yeah, so it's true that the question is jurisdictional. You know, the dispute is not about whether First Choice is going to win on the First Amendment claim, but whether it should be able to get into federal court to present the First Amendment claim. And as First Choice argues at length in its briefing, the issue is that if a nonprofit like First Choice can't get into federal court and it has to stay in state court, and a state court resolves the argument, say it rejects First Choice's First Amendment argument. First choice can't then go to federal court in almost all situations because of res judicata and preclusion issues. And that was actually a point that Justice Jackson pushed the New Jersey attorney on yesterday toward the end of the argument. And basically she said, so what are they supposed to do if you're going to trap them in state court? And he basically said, too bad. And I got the sense that Justice Jackson was not satisfied by that answer. So the big issue is, you know, can nonprofits like this get into federal court to make a First Amendment or other federal claim? And that's important because the New Jersey Attorney General and pregnancy centers aren't the only ones having this type of battle. You know, this issue had come up in New Jersey before related to gun manufacturers. States kind of across the spectrum have used investigatory demands and subpoenas to do both, you know, arguably reasonable investigations and arguably unreasonable investigations of nonprofits or industries or people that they may dislike, which is why this sort of ability to get into a federal forum to assert that there's some retaliation happening for speech is significant.
Yeah, you know, of course, there are a number of differences between state and federal court, and you know, state court systems operate, you know, in different ways in different states. Judges are selected in different ways in different states. There are, of course, very good reasons why litigants might prefer to have their constitutional claims heard in federal court versus state court, for sure. You talked a little bit about sort of the other background issues at play, these uses of subpoenas that we've seen in other places, in other contexts. You know, it's not just necessarily blue state attorney generals going after organizations that we might think of as traditionally aligned with folks on the conservative side of the movement. Of course, red states use administrative subpoenas as well. Are there other background issues like that you think might be helpful for our viewers to understand, or a little bit more of the broader context that might be helful?
I think that the other background issue that's important to know about the case is that there's really two theories that First Choice has for why it should be allowed into federal court. One of them is basically that it showed an objective chill on its rights by the demand for donor information, that kind of inherently chills donors from associating with First Choice by supporting it financially, and this chilling effect is sufficient for Article 3 standing and injury in fact, and therefore ripeness. So the first theory is kind of objective chill, and then the second theory is whether there's a credible threat of enforcement of the investigatory law against First Choice. And so in many cases, especially in the First Amendment context, the federal courts have said that pre-enforcement, so before a statute is actually enforced against you, review is appropriate because the threat of enforcement is sufficiently imminent. The Supreme Court has said in a bunch of cases, a plaintiff doesn't need to wait to expose himself to actual arrest or prosecution to challenge government action that deters constitutional rights. And so First Choice said, you know, even putting aside objective chill, you also have a credible threat that the attorney general is going to drag us into court and make us reveal all these documents and compile all this information and go through this litigation. And in fact, you know, First Choice argued that New Jersey Attorney General had already done that by bringing a state court action and initiating enforcement proceedings. So those are kind of the two big theories of the case, and lots of the oral argument yesterday centered on figuring out which of those theories, you know, the court wanted to go with, or which of those theories would have negative, potentially negative consequences in other areas of the law, which of the theories might be more, you know, kind of one ticket only for this case or have broader implications. So I think, and we'll get to it in a minute, but I think that's important to think about, especially in the context of the United States weighing in this case, and it really only wanted the threat of enforcement theory, and that's what it was pushing at the argument yesterday.
Yeah, so maybe let's talk about that a little bit. So The United States filed a brief, appeared at argument in support of first choice, but they had a different take on which of the theories was most appropriate and what some potential drawbacks might be with one or the other of the theories. So maybe can you explain to us what the United States' position was and how it differed from first choice's?
Sure. So I would say the United States more just emphasized first choice's kind of secondary position. I don't think there was much any daylight really between first choice's threat of enforcement theory and the United States. I think the United States just, it said at argument that it thought the objective chill issue was less fleshed out in the Supreme Court's precedent. And so it sort of suggested that the court go with the threat of enforcement. Again, the idea being that first choice had a credible threat that the AG would bring judicial proceedings to enforce the subpoena. Even just litigation costs from that enforcement would be an injury in fact that would confer Article III jurisdiction. You heard some discussion yesterday in the argument, well, aren't litigation costs not enough for irreparable harm under a preliminary injunction type theory? And the United States answer is yes, but we're talking about just injury in fact. And and so it is an injury in fact, even if it may not be an irreparable harm, and sort of the merits of any preliminary injunction are different from this prerequisite standing ripeness question. And so in some ways, the United States argument is would sweep more broadly than the objective chill argument, because it wouldn't be as important whether there a particular plaintiff could show via affidavits or other evidence an objective chill. It would sort of be enough that there was a credible threat that you could get dragged into court and have to pay lawyers to do that case. And so there, you don't, the courts wouldn't need to think about, and it wouldn't matter whether there was a chilling effect and whether that chilling effect was objectively reasonable.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about the New Jersey Attorney General's position now. So first choice has these two theories, chill, these subpoenas are going to chill our first choices, advocacy efforts. It's going to chill donors' interests in contributing to us and participating in, helping First Choice participate in advocacy on matters of important public concern. The credible threat of enforcement theory you mentioned as well. How did New Jersey respond to those? What was its arguments as to why, in its view, the court should not adopt either of those theories?
Yeah, so it's hard to pin down New Jersey's view because it's changed so much throughout the litigation. And I would say you've seen this in a number of recent cases at the Supreme Court where blue state localities or blue states in the lower courts sort of push very aggressive theories here. That New Jersey's primary argument below was that this is never going to be ripe until a state court actually compels production. And of course, that would mean that a state court would have rejected First Choice's constitutional claim, which would mean that First Choice would be precluded from going to federal court. So basically, New Jersey's position had been, no, you can't ever get into federal court. And even in the brief in opposition at the Supreme Court, that New Jersey seemed to continue kind of pushing that line. But on the merits, and again, I think we've seen this tactic of changing positions in cases like Childs versus Salazar earlier this term. Even to some extent, the Coach Kennedy Bremerton School case. So again, here, a new position on the merits of the Supreme Court argument, which was, yes, if there's a reasonably objective chill, first choice can get in, but New Jersey is basically quibbling over whether first choice's affidavits and complaint state a chill that is reasonably objective. And so really focusing on that more narrow factual question, is there a chill, and kind of parsing word for word the anonymous donor declarations to argue that there is not a reasonably objective chill. And then the other big argument that New Jersey has is focused on whether the subpoena is self-executing or non-self-executing. The difference being a non-self-executing subpoena generally requires the person who issued the subpoena to go to court and ask the court to enforce it, whereas a self-executing subpoena, if you don't comply with it, you are immediately subject to penalties because of that non-compliance with the subpoena itself. In the earlier non-self-executing, you would have to disobey the court order before you'd be subject to penalties. Here, the New Jersey AG, for the first time in this litigation, argues that his investigatory subpoenas are non-self-executing, even though the face of the subpoena says failure to comply with it may lead to contempt. And New Jersey law very clearly says that the subpoena carries the force of law and is subject to immediate penalties. So you heard a lot of the discussion in the argument yesterday centered on this question. Well, is it self-executing? Is it not self-executing? Does it matter? So those are kind of the two main positions that New Jersey has. This is a non-self-executing treaty, non-self-executing subpoena. So nothing's going to happen until a state court does something about it. And First Choice's donors can't show a reasonable chilling effect from just a non-self-executing subpoena.
Yeah, you know, one of what I thought was the most remarkable parts of our argument yesterday, I think it was Justice Alito that was really drilling down on New Jersey. You know, when did you first take the position that this is non-self-executing? And, you know, basically forced the Attorney General to acknowledge that. I think it was just a few years ago in a case against Smith & Wesson, they actually had taken the exact opposite position and have since reversed course. So I think kind of going along with what you mentioned about how we've seen in this case as well as other cases, how, you know, positions sometimes change in ways that are, you know, more conducive to how they want to frame the argument when it actually gets up to the Supreme Court.
Yeah, the answers there were also interesting because New Jersey argued yesterday that they had been consistent in this litigation that subpoenas were non-self-executing. Again, they didn't make any effort to square that reading with the text of the New Jersey law. But if you go back and look at the petition they filed in state court to enforce the subpoena, it asked for contempt because they didn't comply with the subpoena. And so it's hard to see how that, you know, their own filing in state court is consistent with the theory they now have at the Supreme Court.
Yeah. So let's turn to yesterday's argument. What were some of your main takeaways from the argument?
Yeah. So making predictions is always bad, but First Choice is going to win and is probably going to win 9-0. I think the only real question is what route the court takes to get there. I think you could hear that sort of all the themes we've been talking about in questions from the courts. I mean, Justice Barrett was obviously interested in whether the subpoena was self-executing or not self-executing. It sounded like she kind of wanted to assume that it was not self-executing, but still kind of, but didn't think that had great implications perhaps for whether a person could be objectively chilled, even if you get something, and Justice Kagan made this point too, if you get something from the government that says you have to send me these documents, you know, what ordinary person is just going to say, oh, this has no meaning, this doesn't do anything, I don't need to be at all concerned about this. The other justices echoed this point. I mean, Justice Gorsuch said, you know, look at what your law actually says. Look at what position New Jersey you took in the gun cases where you said this was self-executing. You had Justice Thomas reading from the face of the subpoena and say, how could you call this a request when you say that failure to comply with it will lead to contempt? And so I think you saw a lot of pushback on the idea that this wasn't a sufficiently kind of formal government demand that could lead to a reasonably objective chill. So again, I think the big question is what route the court takes to get there. There was some concern that, you know, going with the government's and first choice's secondary threat of enforcement theory could lead to lots of litigation in other cases about other subpoenas. New Jersey's attorney tried to sort of explain how many of these get issued by state governments and what effect it would have if anyone with a credible threat of enforcement just based on litigation costs could get into federal court. There was some pushback on that. On objective chill, it seemed like the justices largely agreed with first choice that the chill here had to be objectively reasonable. I mean, you had Chief Justice Roberts asking, quote, "Do you think there is a credible chilling effect from the state seeking full names, phone numbers, addresses, known place of employment of every one of their donors?" And New Jersey's lawyer said, "I don't think so." And he said, Chief Justice said, how do you know that? And basically New Jersey's attorney said, "Well, we need more affidavits." And the Chief Justice said, "Well, how do you get that affidavit? You want someone to come in and put their name on an affidavit and say, I'm chilled. I don't want to reveal my name. That's not going to work, is it?" And sort of there was a pile on then about the sufficiency of the chilling affidavits from Justices Gorsuch, Alito, Barrett, and Kagan. Kagan emphasizing that courts enforce something like 98% of subpoenas like this. So I think in some ways, despite the United States's argument, it seemed like the justices thought the objective chill here was pretty obvious. I think that conclusion also follows from some of the court's other cases, like Americans for Prosperity, when the court held that there was a chilling effect from similar donor disclosure. So in some ways, it seems like that's kind of the obvious way for the court to go. A quote here I had from Justice Kagan: "An ordinary person, one of the funders for this organization, is going to be presented with this subpoena and then told, but don't worry, it has to be stamped by a court. That's not going to be very reassuring, is it?" So again, an easy way for them to deal with this would be to say, we don't need to decide whether it's self-executing or non-self-executing. We don't need to decide that issue of state law, even though it looks very self-executing on its face and under New Jersey statutes. Either way, there's an objective chill here because, you know, for the same reason we found an objective chill in these other cases. You do have the United States arguing that you should take the threat of enforcement approach. And it wasn't clear that the justices thought that was wrong either. So, mm-hmm. So either approach seems possible.
Yeah, I thought it was really interesting when the attorney for the New Jersey Attorney General tried to start like parsing the tense in some of the affidavits and saying, oh, you know, it was past tense and that wasn't enough. They needed to like suggest, you know, some sort of, you know, future tense rather than saying, I didn't do this. They need to say, I would not have done this or I would have done this. And the justices found that completely, I think, unpersuasive. That was, I think, one of the pile on moments that you mentioned that they ran into there. Right. So you mentioned a number of the interesting exchanges that happened at yesterday's oral argument. Are there any other exchanges that stood out to you that you think our viewers might be interested to know about?
Yeah. So one exchange that was interesting, I don't think it'll have an effect maybe on exactly how the court resolves this. But in some ways, this case does play up that the First Amendment is sometimes unique in that courts will relax some of the ordinary requirements to get relief in First Amendment cases. You see that in a wide range of doctrines, you know, the way facial as applied worked. And Justice Jackson had a couple questions playing up that fact. You know, we in other cases, the courts require a really clear showing of actual or imminent injury, whereas in the First Amendment, sort of a credible threat of enforcement seems to be a lesser standard. Justice Jackson flagged the difference between being concerned about a threat of enforcement in terms of First Amendment rights with Fourth Amendment rights. She mentioned potential citizens worried about having adverse interactions with ICE as one example. And so I do think one interesting component that has run through this case and other cases is how the First Amendment is or should be treated differently from mm-hmm. other constitutional provisions. Again, I don't think that's going to have a direct effect on this case, but I do think it's something interesting for people to think about in terms of how this case might be considered and what doctrines might be relevant if it were a Fourth Amendment concern about unreasonable searches or seizures rather than a First Amendment case.
Mm-hmm. That was interesting too. You mentioned earlier, Christopher, that New Jersey's Attorney General tried to play up this like Pandora's box concern that if the court ruled in First Choice's favor, be opening this Pandora's box to, you know, all these challenges to subpoenas. You know, several justices had questions about that, you know, hard to know, but just based on the questions. But my take, at least, was that that argument didn't seem to have too much purchase with the justices. You know, maybe because it seemed pretty clear here that there would be an objective chill, and you know, maybe also because New Jersey hadn't really identified any other examples of this sort of theoretical Pandora's box.
Yeah, I think I agree. I mean, New Jersey really struggled to come up with any examples that would work. The examples that threw out, you know, car dealerships and that sort of thing just seemed to fall flat. Justice Barrett emphasized that, well, hey, at least some other states really have self-executing subpoenas, and we don't see sort of a flood of litigation from those places. And so, I think in terms of New Jersey's answer to the threat of enforcement theory, they struggled to come up with the parade of horribles.
Yeah. So shifting topics just a little bit, there were a number of interesting amicus briefs filed in the case. You filed one, I filed one as well. A particular note, the ACLU actually filed a brief on behalf of First Choice. What do you make of the fact that the amicus support in this case didn't necessarily line up along standard ideological lines?
Yeah, so I think that reflects the fact that, you know, whether a nonprofit organization or religious organization or some other type of organization can get access to a federal forum to present a federal constitutional claim just really isn't a matter of you know, conservative or liberal or left or right, but it's a principle that kind of applies across the board. The ACLU's brief highlights examples of what it sees as kind of red states deploying similar subpoenas in similar ways. And Justice Kavanaugh actually quoted extensively from the ACLU's brief at the argument yesterday and asked New Jersey's counsel to respond. So clearly it's a brief that the court was taking seriously. And, you know, that Justice Kavanaugh said that the ACLU provided a common sense framework. A speaker is not obligated to wait for formal enforcement before challenging the constitutionality of state action. And a subpoena seeking sensitive donor information can chill a disfavored speaker's protective associations long before it's ever enforced. You know, he and others repeatedly use that phrase, kind of a common sense intuition. So I think that accounts for the fact that First Choice, you know, was overwhelmingly and lopsidedly supported by amicus from kind of across the ideological spectrum.
Yeah. A lot more amicus briefs filed on behalf of First Choice in this case than on behalf of New Jersey. It was quite unbalanced in terms of the numbers of briefs, which I think probably is explained by what you just mentioned about how this really affects people all across the spectrum. And, you know, all of us want to be able to vindicate our rights in court. So, you know, this is about our access to courts. It's not so much, you know, a standard ideological divide, even though what we are dealing with here is a pregnancy resource center. I mentioned that you filed an amicus brief in the case as well on behalf of Samaritan's Purse. Do you want to tell us a little bit about Samaritan's Purse and the arguments that you made in your brief?
Yeah, sure. Before I do that, I do just want to flag that one other interesting component of the arguments yesterday was the United States' sort of insistence that this rule wouldn't apply to it. It sort of invoked the APA and said, well, Congress hasn't actually provided a cause of action. So unlike Section 1983, Congress hasn't provided a cause of action for anybody to come into court claiming a First Amendment chill from a federal subpoena by and large. And so, we don't actually have to worry about this. And you could see a couple of the justices kind of pointed out the double standard there and the seeming contradiction between, arguing how important this is, but also saying, but we don't actually want to be subject to this.
Justice Kagan had a pretty funny question where she was something like, would you be standing up here making the same argument if you would be subject to, the rule that you're advocating for?
Right. Yeah. So anyway, to go back to your question, yes. So Samaritan's Purse filed a brief in this case. They deploy emergency field hospitals in disaster areas. In 2020, they were asked to deploy one in Central Park in New York by then Governor Andrew Cuomo and the Mount Sinai Health System. They set up a field hospital there with 68 beds to deal with COVID. Again, this was at the invitation of the state and local officials in New York. But because they are a Christian organization and have a belief that marriage is between one man and one woman, sort of there was this immediate outcry that how dare this organization come and provide medical assistance to anyone who needs it. And so the New York City Commission on Human Rights served a similar investigatory demand for production of documents on Good Friday in 2020, asking for all sorts of internal policies, sensitive medical treatment information, training materials, purportedly to see whether Samaritan's Purse was denying treatment to anyone based on their identities. Of course, it was not. It was treating whoever walked in the door and while subjecting all of Samaritan's Purse's volunteers to sort of an environment with 100% COVID. So, this is kind of a theme that's been played out, not just against First Choice and not just in New Jersey, but the use of subpoenas to harass organizations that local or state officials simply dislike ideologically. Our brief argued that that any government action, whether it's a self-executing subpoena, non-self-executing subpoena, a particularly nasty letter, could sufficiently chill citizens' speech or association. And the more coercive the government action is, the more likely it is that the claimant can show an objectively reasonable chill. And, so here we argued that this is about as coercive as it gets. It says, give us donor names or you will be held in contempt. And from everything we know about donor behavior, that's obviously objectively reasonable to expect a chill from that sort of mandated disclosure.
Yeah. I think that there were a number of very effective amicus briefs that were filed where amici shared stories similar to Samaritan's Purse getting subpoenas, how that affected them and I don't necessarily want to say, maybe like instilling fear or things like that, but really how receiving these subpoenas really does have an impact on organizations, including and perhaps particularly nonprofits that are trying to do charitable work when they get these subpoenas. It really can throw them and introduce some really real concerns for them and their continued ability to continue doing their work. I mentioned that I filed an amicus brief in the case on behalf of a number of national religious organizations, including the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, National Association of Evangelicals, Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, a number of others, explaining that these sorts of investigatory demands also are of concern to religious organizations, particularly when it comes to religious organizations' First Amendment rights, under the church autonomy doctrine and how these sorts of intrusive demands impact religious organizations' ability to carry out their free exercise of religion. So really there is, I think, a deep concern among a number of organizations, including nonprofits, about their rights to be able to challenge what they view as, you know, intrusive and at times unlawful investigatory demands. So let's see here. We asked to make sure that we leave some time for Q&A from viewers. If I have the little pop-up here open correctly, it doesn't look like that we have any viewer Q&A at the moment, but if any folks who are watching do have any questions for Christopher or me, please feel free to chime in and let us know. We'd be happy to answer any questions that folks may have. Maybe while we give some of our viewers a chance if they'd like to ask questions. Christopher, was there anything else that stood out to you or that you had in your notes that you thought might be interesting for viewers to hear that we haven't gotten to yet?
Let's see here. I mean, I think the other topic that came up at the argument was the difference, and it's hard to separate these things, and the federal government actually explained that as one of the reasons it wanted the threat of enforcement theory rather than the objective chill. The difference between an objective chill sufficient to get a First Amendment claimant in the door, to sufficient to confer an injury in fact, for standing or ripeness, with the merits of the First Amendment claim. And so I think a number of the justices highlighted that distinction. There was an interesting discussion back and forth about whether it mattered for an objective chill whether the person was likely to win on the merits. And so, in other words, the theory seemed to be, well, you could say the donors can't show the showing from the donors or the claimant kind of depended on whether they were likely to win. And if they weren't likely to win, then they couldn't really get in the door. And so it seemed like all the attorneys were kind of rejecting that position, that saying, well, no, your likelihood of success on the merits isn't a factor in whether you can get in the door in terms of standing or ripeness, which is consistent, of course, with the Supreme Court's precedent in a number of cases. But it was one aspect that both Justice Sotomayor and Jackson brought up a couple times.
Yeah, well, one thing that struck me as well is, you know, I felt like the New Jersey Attorney General was trying to like make these very, very fine distinctions. You know, you talk about what the face of this penis says, but then say, well, you know, you can vote the state law, or there's this Third Circuit decision. And then in the declarations, again, trying to parse the tense in the declarations, and, oh, you know, was the tense used correctly? And the justices really didn't seem to be having any of that. They really seem to be focusing on, like, okay, you know, we're not talking about a team of lawyers here who are looking at this declaration who, you know, are super sophisticated at this. You know, we're asking, you know, what is somebody at a nonprofit when they get the subpoena, how are they going to react when they get this? They're not going to go, you know, do some close analysis of statute, go pull up some Third Circuit decision from years ago. You know, how is a normal, reasonable person going to react to that? And I think that it was pretty clear to the justices, and I think pretty clear to, I think, you know, most people who look at this, that, yeah, this is, you know, if you get something like this, if the subpoena itself says, you know, you're going to face sanctions or contempt if you don't comply, even if, as a matter of fact, the AG still has to go to court to get some order, like, you know, it seemed like a lot of justices were kind of saying, you know, come on, what is a reasonable, normal person going, how are they going to react here? And certainly on that front, I think that weighs in First Choice's favor. So we've gotten a few audience questions. We have one viewer who asks, if the Supreme Court decides for First Center, what is the next procedural step in the case?
Yeah, so the case would go back down for the federal district court to decide the merits of First Choice's federal constitutional claims. And so I believe the parties agreed to kind of stay the subpoena enforcement proceedings while this federal proceeding was stating out was playing out. So what would happen next basically is what the district court would say: has First Choice presented a cognizable First Amendment claim? In other words, has it shown that the donors or its own speech are burdened by the subpoena, which, you know, it seems pretty obvious that it would be able to show that, given the Supreme Court's other cases like Americans for Prosperity. And then, you know, can the government somehow justify that burden on First Amendment rights? And so basically the district court would be litigating the First Amendment merits.
Mm-hmm. And thereby avoiding this preclusion trap you mentioned, and I think at least Justice Jackson had highlighted that they'll be able to get the merits of their constitutional claims adjudicated by a federal court rather than, you know, only in the state court. We have another viewer who's asked, do you see the claims brought by First Choice against New Jersey being applied in the Arctic Frost context by nonprofit targets of the Jack Smith subpoenas? So I think basically how might this apply in other contexts, particularly with Arctic Frost and those Jack Smith subpoenas?
Yeah, I don't think I know enough about those to be able to speculate. You know, I think how this would apply elsewhere will to some extent depend on which theory the court takes. If we're just talking about credible threat of enforcement, then, you know, lots of subpoena recipients presumably would be able to show that. But the question is, you know, do they have sort of an underlying constitutional claim that could come in the door at that point? If we're talking about objective chill, you know, I think that becomes a bit harder for people to show, perhaps because it's more of a First Amendment focused inquiry. But I don't have a feeling about this particular context.
Yeah. Well, of course, it depend on the content of those subpoenas, you know, what they're asking for and what constitutional offenses the subpoena recipients might raise. But I would think that, probably a very good chance that there might be some application, depending on how the court rules in this case. So we have a question. This is a little bit longer question. So a viewer asks, he says, I assume this will only have res judicata or collateral estoppel effects on First Choice in New Jersey, but you mentioned other states engaging in this activity. What are those other states and will they have ways to distinguish this? Also, what about federal agency or even congressional subpoena action without a warrant? Is this just limited to donor lists or can it be drawn more broadly? So I think there may be a few things going on in this question. So questions about what other states are doing, which we did talk about a little bit earlier, but maybe we can just briefly reprise that. And then how might this impact federal agency or congressional subpoenas? That I think probably goes back to what you mentioned earlier, Christopher, about what the United States said about how, yes, the United States also issues these sorts of administrative subpoenas, but under the APA, there has to be final agency action. And so in many cases, even if the court adopts the credible threat of enforcement theory, wouldn't necessarily have impacts on ability to challenge federal administrative subpoenas because of how the APA is how the APA is worded. Congressional subpoenas, I don't myself have a lot of knowledge about how congressional subpoenas work. I assume that Congress probably has to go to court to get the court to enforce subpoenas. So there might be some analogs there between this case and what happens there. But going back to the first part of this viewer's question, he asked, what are those other states that are participating that issue these sorts of subpoenas? Will they have ways to distinguish this? I think all 50 states regularly and very frequently use administrative subpoenas. Will they have ways to distinguish it? That'll, of course, depend on their statutes, whether their administrative subpoenas are self-executing or non-self-executing, what the content of the subpoenas say. We've talked about how in this case, that, you know, even though New Jersey argues the subpoena is non-self-executing, the face of the subpoena threatens, consequences if you don't comply. So obviously, will depend on the content of those subpoenas as well. Christopher, do you have any additional thoughts in response to that my question.
Yeah, I would. I think that's all right. I would just say that it's going to depend on, you know, what the subpoena actually demands and who the subpoena's recipient is, and sort of what legal claims could possibly be brought. You know, I think that, you know, even if the court went with a credible threat of enforcement theory, there still has to be some federal claim that can be asserted. And so, you know, the First Amendment ones seem the most obvious. Other mm-hmm. ones, you know, in your mind run of state subpoena cases, it's just unlikely that a subpoena recipient is going to have a meritorious federal constitutional claim. So I think states would have ways to distinguish this. Part of the question asks, is this limited to donor lists? And I would say no, although I think, as the Chief Justice's questions sort of suggested, that it goes after donors, makes it particularly egregious and kind of a particularly obvious chilling effect. Mm-hmm. But I do think it would apply more broadly.
Yeah. We have another question. Did segregation authorities ever subpoena civil rights organizations for donor info during the 50s and 60s? If you pull up First Choice's opening merits brief in this case, you'll actually see that they lead off their brief with reference to NAACP versus Alabama, which is, I think, the most, you know, there were several Supreme Court cases from the 50s and 60s that dealt with efforts by segregationists to try and stop efforts by the NAACP by demanding donor lists, you know, names of donors and sort of, you know, trying to get at it that way. The NAACP case, NAACP versus Alabama, I think, is probably the most famous of those. And that's exactly how First Choice leads off its brief. So the answer to that question is yes.
Yeah.
All right. So let's see. I think those are all the questions. Oh, I'm sorry. One more question. Did you say the parties consented to staying enforcement of the subpoena pending this appeal, or was it under a state or federal TRO? The client receives an administrative subpoena threatening a constitutional right, is seeking injunctive relief from a federal court of competent jurisdiction among the preferred initial steps in response. So the answer to the question about the stay is yes, right?
That's correct. I don't want to swear to it because the procedural history here is pretty involved, but I believe that's correct. That there wasn't a state or federal TRO or preliminary injunction because the federal court believed they didn't have jurisdiction.
Yeah. And so as a second part of this question, if the client receives administrative subpoena threatening a constitutional right, is seeking injunctive relief from federal court competent jurisdiction among the preferred initial steps. You know, I mean, I suppose it's a matter of litigation strategy. But at least as far as I read what First Choice is doing here, that's really what First Choice wanted to do, is they wanted to be able to go to federal court and get an injunction from the federal court.
Right. I think that's right. You know, for the reasons you flagged, if a state court resolves it and a state court may not take as seriously a federal constitutional claim as a federal court would, again, that kind of depends on the state court and a bunch of other things. But if that's the concern, that a state court might kind of gloss over a federal constitutional claim and then preclude you from going into federal court, then you probably want to be in federal court sooner rather than later.
Yeah, I did think it was interesting that, one of New Jersey's responses to this preclusion trap argument was, well, it's not, you know, you can still, once you've gone through the state court process, you can still seek review from the U.S. Supreme Court. So, you know, you can still get, you know, theoretically federal court review of your constitutional claim. But of course, we all know getting cert from the Supreme Court is extremely difficult. And so I think probably in almost all cases, almost all litigants will want their federal constitutional claims heard by federal court in the first instance, rather than trying to, you know, cross their fingers and hope that they have some long shot chance of getting review by the U.S. Supreme Court at the end of the day.
Yep.
Yeah. So, all right. Well, I think we're about out of time here, and it looks like we've gotten through the questions in the Q&A. Thanks very much, Christopher. This has been a super interesting discussion. I hope our viewers have found this interesting as well. Thank you, our audience members who submitted questions. Really, really great questions. As I mentioned at the outset, you know, sometimes these jurisdictional arguments can feel a little bit, you know, a little bit dry, a little bit technical. But I think that given the context here and sort of how we're seeing these subpoenas used nationwide, I think this really is a case that could have some important consequences going forward for nonprofits and charitable organizations, really on all sides of the spectrum. So All right. Thanks so much.
Thanks. Take care.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. For more information about the Federal Society, the Practice Groups, and to become a Federal Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.